you know, some cows didn't come at all. Some were taking 2.2 pounds a day of mineral. So there's no way to really regulate what they're actually getting on any kind of free choice product. So force feeding is beneficial in my mind.
May the Forage be with you. A podcast brought to you by the Peace River Forage Association. Welcome to episode 4. I'm your host, Nadia Mori. Today we pick up part 2 of my discussion with Barry Yaremcio, cattle nutritionist extraordinaire, as we continue our chat on cattle nutrition. If you missed part 1, be sure to check out episode 3, where we did a deep dive on mineral supplementation and outlined a step-by-step guide to forage testing. In this second part, Barry shares various strategies on preventing bloat when cattle transition onto a high-percentage alfalfa pasture, why your bull might be shooting blanks, and a guideline on how much to spend on loose minerals to keep both your cows and your bottom line in good health. After the interview, we also take a peek into the Forage Fact Sheet vault and a look at Forage Fact Sheet number 83. And guess who helped develop that? Yes, Barry Yaremcio. So what better Forage Fact Sheet to combine with his interview? Now, without further ado, let's roll into part 2 of Barry's chat on cattle nutrition.
When animals are in dry lot versus on pasture, obviously that's a huge difference in nutritional experience that the animal is having. What are some of the key things to remember in each scenario? And I realize that's a rather large and broad question, but maybe you could just narrow it down to some of the key differences in considerations.
Turning cows out onto pasture or backgrounding calves onto pasture, you need a minimum of 3 leaves on the plant so that it has a chance to develop the roots and grow and produce you a good amount of forage during the year. Only take 50% of the growth that is there and then move them on to a new paddock. Because if you graze it down to the bottom, then it's going to take another 2 weeks or 3 weeks to start regrowing. So being kind to your pasture right off is probably the biggest economic advantage that you can have, because for every day that you turn your cows out early in the spring, you shorten your grazing season by 3 days. Your grasses and legumes early season are fairly low in fibers, high in energy, high in protein, generally high in calcium and phosphorus as well. So it's a lot easier getting these animals to grow and meet their requirements. They will all be short of the trace minerals, copper, manganese, zinc, and selenium. So for those that have blue salt blocks, put them under the shed, leave them there so that next fall or when the first snowfall comes, you can put those salt blocks on the back of the truck. And when there's a bad storm, you've got enough ballast in the back of the truck that you can buck the drifts and get home. So blue block is something that I've been trying to educate people that it's not going to do the best job for you. Spending that extra $4 or $5 a block will make a big difference in the long run. Grass that is actively growing has more than adequate amounts of vitamin A and E. You're going to be getting the vitamin D from the sunlight. So supplementing the vitamins in the growing season is not as critical compared to feeding dry feed. 90 days after hay is cut, the vitamins start to deteriorate and you have to start supplementing. If you're making silage bales or chopped silage or piles of silage, all the vitamin precursors are destroyed during that fermentation process. So you can get away with a little bit lower levels of vitamins in the summertime. Calcium and phosphorus, if you've got a good mixed forage in early growing stages, they typically tend to be reasonably good. But here again, it might be worth for curiosity's sake, going out there middle of June and just taking a knife with you and cutting some product or cutting some forage off about 3 inches above the ground where the cows generally graze to, and send it away for analysis just to see where you're at. So you're just to double check to see which product you need. On pasture, it all depends. If you've got a straight grass pasture, you're probably going to be short of calcium. once the heading stage is reached. And if it's an older stand where it hasn't been fertilized much for the last 10, 15 years, you're definitely going to be deficient in phosphorus and magnesium as well. So giving a blanket recommendation for pastures is a little bit tough. And that's where I like to see a feed test and actually get an idea where things are at.
For sure, because pastures from one field to the next could be so different, even in composition and what's in there, how old the stand is. So many factors to consider, for sure.
Yeah, you bet. The other thing that I would consider, if you've got a couple hundred tons of silage left over from your winter feeding period and the grass is coming slow, that silage will probably not make it through the summer in great condition. You can get mold formations, deterioration in quality. So instead of leaving that silage sit out there till next fall, maybe feed 50% of the feed requirements and use up that silage until it's gone. And that does two things. It uses the feed that you have, and it also reduces the pressure on that pasture so that it has a better chance to grow and get established. I know that some people use a sacrifice pasture in the spring when they put the calves out with the cows. Throwing that silage on there will reduce the impact on that pasture that has been used very early in the season, and it may prolong the productivity of that piece of land.
You talked before about how when the animals go on fresh green pasture, it's so much lusher and there's lower fiber. Similarly, when animals are going into a very high alfalfa pasture or bloating legume pasture, there's often concerns, and some producers seem a bit more successful in managing that. Do you have some of your key considerations when animals are going into such lush situations?
Management is key when you're putting animals into a high legume pasture. One is if there's a limited water supply, or if the cows are required to drink out of a stock tank or something, you know, water coming from a well, there's a product on the market called AlphaSure, which reduces bloat problems. Some people, even though there's no claims for some of these, there has been success with people feeding Bovatec on pasture to help reduce bloat. But mechanically, the big difference is when you're changing cattle from a grass pasture to a legume pasture, the makeup of the microbes in the rumen change. And you have to give that rumen time to adjust and be accustomed to the legume before you put them in free choice. So if you've got bales of an alfalfa grass hay in the yard, go out mid-afternoon and roll out 30%, 40% of their daily feed requirements of that alfalfa grass hay so that the cows are actually eating some legume. Do that for 3 or 4 days. And then turning the cows out into the pasture. That's one way of doing it. If you've got an electric fence and you can move cows in and out of the pasture between the high legume pasture and the one that they're already in, turn them in mid-afternoon, let them graze for 2 or 3 hours, pull them back out, do that for 4 or 5 days, and that will give them adjustment time to adjust as well. The reason that I'm saying do this in the mid-afternoon is cattle have three main feeding times in the day. First thing in the morning, about 2 o'clock or mid-afternoon, and again, early evening. The biggest meal is the first one in the morning, so you don't want to let them into the alfalfa or provide that bale of hay mid or early morning, because they're going to gorge themselves or eat as much as they can of that bale, and that could cause the problem. Let them fill up on the grass hay or whatever feed they're on mid-afternoon. They'll take 15, 20% of their daily feed intake with the alfalfa, therefore reducing the risk. So There's a couple ideas that seem to work fairly well.
Now, we talked different pastures, different feed, but if we look at the animals, what would be some of the key differences when you're trying to feed heifers versus trying to feed your cows? Again, a huge one, but maybe...
No, it's a great question. I'm just trying to figure out how to frame it. Okay, for the mature cows, they are typically maintaining themselves. They really don't have to gain a lot of weight. The first calf heifers, they're only at 85% of mature body weight when they deliver their first calf. So they have to gain a pound a day before they deliver their second calf so that they're fully grown at 4 years of age. So the first calf heifers should be on a higher quality pasture than a mature cow. When you're looking at a replacement heifer, there's two different stages that we have to be careful. Once they are bred and physiologically developed, they can gain that pound to a pound and a quarter a day. But when the calves are growing, if you've got a 500 or 600 weight heifer that you're going to keep as a replacement, when that animal hits puberty, the udder develops four times faster than any other tissue in the body. And with that, if they are gaining more than a pound and three quarters or 2 pounds a day and being really pushed with a fair amount of grain, what happens is that extra energy gets laid down in the udder as fat and not as milk secreting tissue. And therefore that limits their milk production for the rest of their life. So you can't really you don't want to overdevelop or push those heifers from 600 to 850, 900 pounds so that you're not affecting their milk production capability. And then once they are at 900 weight, you want to have them at 85% of mature body weight by the time they deliver their first calf. So there's a couple different things to consider when you're looking at those three different types of animal.
That's a good reminder too, that it will take the animal on average 4 years to reach maturity, and that there's still considerations that need to go on over that whole period.
The other thing that I found most intriguing is cattle are just like people. They lose their baby teeth and then they get the mature teeth. And at 2 years of age, that's generally when they have that transition. So, you know, if they're losing teeth, they can't chew as well, they can't eat as well. So that puts additional stress on those animals to maintain body condition between delivery of the first calf and the breeding season.
Now, we talked about our heifers, the cows, different pastures. What about the bulls? I feel like sometimes we think of them at the time of breeding, and then they're being shuffled off to a separate pasture and left to their own devices. But what are some of the things that we should also keep in mind to have best bull performance?
A bull should be in good condition, not over fat, not skinny. So a body condition score of 3 to 3.5, maybe a 4 is suitable, because once the breeding season starts, the bull doesn't think of food. He thinks of other things. So having him with the proper trace mineral nutrition and vitamin nutrition prior to the start of the breeding season is critical, because that'll affect sperm motility and the number of sperm that he's able to develop. And the other side of the coin is, anytime a bull has a problem with any kind of infection and has a fever, that higher body temperature radiates down to the testicles. And that may be enough to kill off the sperm that he has in storage. And he could be temporarily infertile, or he might be sterile for 30 to 60 days. So if you run into a bull that has foot rot or some other injury or some other infection for any reason, he may be mounting, he might be doing his job, but he's not going to get the job done. If you've got something with that infection or the fever, pull him out and replace him. That's the best advice I can give you on that one. On a casual basis, I'm not a veterinarian, I can't prescribe how to treat them, but I've read too many papers where guys have run into problems with, well, everything was going good up to this point in time, and then when they put it back together, yeah, well, he had some foot rot. And that's where I'm coming from on that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. I also heard you talk about in one of your other presentations about how straw can be really important in the wintertime to protect the testy from the weather.
This winter was a prime example. In the month of February, we had temperatures down to minus 30, minus 40, minus 50. And going through a couple herds, I noticed that there was frostbite on the bottom segment of the testicles of the bulls. And when the vets came out and tested them, they found that they were basically unable to produce any more sperm. They were basically infertile because of that frostbite. Sometimes it's permanent, sometimes it's temporary, but bedding for bulls is critical to make sure that all their parts are still in function, proper functioning order.
Yeah, that would be an expensive impact right there.
Yeah.
And along with bedding, I would say also shelter, right? If we're talking pasture, that these animals have some place to get out of the wind.
If you can provide bedding to cows or bulls, that reduces the amount of heat that is lost to the ground, especially if there's snow there or wet snow. The straw reduces the losses by 25%. So the maintenance energy requirements drop by 25%. Same thing with having trees or some sort of temporary wind fences in place so that they're not out in the open wind. That, again, will reduce their energy requirements by 10 to 20% as well. So yeah, taking good care of them is important. Now, when you do get down to minus 20, that's the point where you hit the lower critical temperature of cattle. In other words, they can keep themselves warm by digesting the feed that they eat down to minus 20, but beyond that drop, they need extra grain or extra energy to keep warm. They will eat more, but my recommendation is at minus 30 at noon, give them 2 extra pounds of grain a day. At minus 40, give them an extra 4 pounds of grain. That should keep them warm and prevent them from losing weight. On the other side, when you listen to the radio or wherever you're getting your weather reports from, a couple, 3 days before the weather actually starts to moderate and get warmer, start reducing that grain. Because if you're still at that extra 4 pounds of grain at minus 20, those cows, as strange as it may sound, they'll be under heat stress. They can't take off their winter coat, and that extra heat from the grain is keeping them very warm, so they're going to back off on their feed intake. So manage the reduction in the amount of feed you're giving so that by the time the weather is normal, they're back to their ration that they should be getting.
Mm-hmm. Now, I just wanted to go back. We had talked a little bit about supplements before. And when you walk into a dealership, right, and there's all these fancy looking bags and some have flashy advertisement and some are on sale, how would you even start to sort out, like when you're standing there, how to make the best informed choice on which package that you actually should be getting?
The decision should be made based on what the animal requires. You know, you might have a product out there with copper at 5,000 parts per million, and the next one's only at 3,000. The key is not what the label says, but a combination of the concentration in the label plus the information on how much is expected to be fed on a daily basis. So if you've got that two different products, one's at 100 grams of intake and the other one's at 50 grams, so let's use 3,000 milligrams per kilogram of copper times 100 grams, they will get 300 milligrams of supplementation. The bag with 5,000 milligrams per kg of copper with only 50 grams of intake, you'll only get 2,500 milligrams of intake. So you've got to do the math. It's not just what's on the label, but you have to look at the nutrient consumption or mineral consumption rate as well. There's a lot of times that a commercial product will do a reasonable job, and sometimes you have to combine two or three different products. So, for example, most minerals being short of vitamin E, you can find a vitamin E product that can be fed on the farm, which is either a 40,000 IU per kilogram or 50,000 IU per kilogram product. And you may need to make a mixture of 90%. 95% mineral, 5% vitamin E to meet requirements. But there again, it takes a little bit more work with cow bites or a ration balancing program to do that little bit of fine tuning. And there are times where, you know, I find that magnesium levels at 1 or 2% in a mineral isn't quite enough. They might have to add another 10 grams or 5 grams of magnesium oxide to prevent downer cows. So don't be afraid to mix and match. Or the other side of the coin is, if you've got enough animals and you can see that you're going to need a minimum of 1 ton of a product, sometimes a custom mineral does a better job and saves you a lot of work by mixing different things at home.
Awesome. And now that all our smartphones have a calculator on them, there's really no excuse why you couldn't whip that out and quickly do your calculations while you're standing in that store.
You bet. Yeah.
You touched a little bit on tubs, lick tubs. What are some of the things that you really have to keep in mind?
Lick tub sales continue to increase year after year. So they're still in favor with the producers. There are places where these tubs work very well. For example, if you've got lots of late season pasture growth that you want to have the cows graze on, typically that material is low in protein. So putting out a 30% lick tub will improve the intake of forages and allow you to keep them out in pasture a longer period of time. For the mineral side of things, when CFIA or Canadian Food Inspection Agency registers a tub, what they do is they take samples from at various times during the pouring process, or they core the tubs out of a certain batch. And the nutrients have to be within a certain variation or percentage variation compared to the label before they will get registration. They want to have a uniform product from start to finish, which makes sense. Now, the two nutrients that are very, very hard to keep in suspension are calcium and phosphorus. And that's why you see levels typically 2, 3, maybe 4% for those two nutrients. So they're very low. And in those situations, they're not going to get as much calcium and phosphorus as they should be getting. And therefore, you may have to put out a feeder with some dry mineral or dry salt mineral combination to get what they need that's not available through the tub. So those are the ones that you have to take a little bit more time and figure out what to do. The other side of the coin is I looked at some of the tags this winter with the feeding consumption or with the consumption rates that were expected and the cost of these tubs. Some of them were in that 40 to 50 cents per head per day range. Others were at $1.50.
Wow.
So economics comes into play with any product that you're feeding. And right now, to do a, if you're using a dry mineral salt vitamin combination, should be 20 cents a day per head or less. Protein would be extra, but if you're looking at just the minerals, it shouldn't cost you more than 20 cents a day on the high end.
Mm. And do you feel the animal is able to achieve the intake that's kind of listed on the tub?
It is possible. Depends on what they've got in the tub, how hard it is, what the moisture content is, and what the products are in there. But the bigger thing with free choice tub or free choice mineral and salt intake is it is variable. For the salt and mineral side of things, Rob Hand did some work in the 90s up in the Barrhead area where he found that on average, cows only come for mineral once every 4 or 4.5 days. And their intake ranged from 1 gram to 1,100 grams a day or per visit. So, you know, some cows didn't come at all. Some were taking 2.2 pounds a day of mineral. So there's no way to really regulate what they're actually getting on any kind of free choice product. So force feeding is beneficial in my mind.
It probably relates back to the fact that the cow really only regulates the salt intake at the end of the day, right?
That is the only nutrient that they really know regulate by themselves. The rest of it, it's up to us to do a good job for them.
What are the things, if producers are looking for help and they remember your name. What are some of the things that you can help people with in their nutrition programs?
I can do anything from answering the simple questions all the way up to taking feed samples, sending them away from analysis, putting together feeding programs. If they want to have a custom mineral or a custom pellet put together, I can do that. I tender any product that needs to be custom made is tendered out to various feed companies. They get a standard formula that they have to mix it to. They give me a price, and then I go back to the producer and say, okay, here's the range in prices. Who do you want to deal with? So there's transparency that way. If somebody wants a little bit of help with, you know, looking at the cows to get a second set of eyes on them, I can come out and evaluate cow condition. If they've got facilities, we can actually do some hands-on body condition scoring. If they want some help to rejig or modify their handling facilities or corrals, I can help redesign with that. Basically anything from soup to nuts. Like you mentioned before, I was a district agriculturalist way back when, and mm-hmm. we did a little bit of everything there. And after all these years, if I don't know, I've got friends and people in my network that can give me a hand if I'm stumped.
Yeah, I'm sure you'd be super well connected. And like you said, it's a team approach, right? It's you and the vet and the producer and whoever else you might have to bring on. What's the best way for people to get in touch with you if they're having some questions for you?
If they go to beefconsultant.com, that's my website. And that's where they'll find my contact information. If they want to call me directly, my phone number is 403-741-6032.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time, Barry, and sharing lots of tidbits and things for people to keep in mind. I think there should be something in there for everybody.
Welcome back. Now, before we dive into the Forage Fact Sheet Vault, I just wanted to share a little inside note. I used to do Toastmasters, and if you don't know what Toastmasters is, it's a place where you can learn and improve your public speaking skills. And I always advocated when I was working with other people and trying to help them on their public speaking that listening back to your own work is the best way to discover your flaws and fix your mistakes. And boy, oh boy, listening to myself doing interviews is a very humbling experience. So if you ever want to get better and notice all the repetitive things that you're doing in your speech, listen to a recording of yourself talk. I promise you, it'll be very insightful. Okay, now after that sidebar, let's dive into the vault of forage fact sheets. Today, we're looking at forage fact sheet number 83, beef nutrition, what to look at and how much. That was actually produced back in 2013, and it was done with the great support of Barry Yaremcio. Before you look at number 83 in the forage fact sheets, it's very valuable to go back to number 18, which explains in great detail how to do forage feed sampling. For example, it points out that it's a good thing to refrigerate dry hay samples and freeze haylage and silage samples to preserve their quality until you can send them into the analysis lab. It's also always a good idea to send your samples into the lab at the beginning of the week so they have a chance to get there and don't sit in some post office over the weekend. Fact sheet number 18 also talks about how to borrow a forage probe, which you can do from the Peace River Forage Association, how to make a probe, or where you can buy one. Now, after you get your samples back, you can also look at forage fact sheet number 20, which we also highlighted in episode 3 of this podcast. In fact sheet number 83, you can get more detailed information on the percentages of crude protein and total digestible nutrients that you will need for beef cows and feeder cattle as they move through their different stages of development. A special note that Barry added in terms of adjusting the TDN values for the Peace region is that labs use area-specific formulas to estimate the TDN of feeds. However, feeds grown in the Peace region have different physical properties, for example, less fiber and more protein, than those grown in other areas, say the United States. For the Peace Region grown feeds that are sent out of the area to be analyzed, the formula used can provide less accurate TDN results. Research has shown that acid detergent fiber, or abbreviated as ADF, consistently provides the correct energy values of feeds. This is because ADF is a measure of all the indigestible components of a feed, such as cellulose and lignin, and not a product of a formula, which is the case for TDN. So Forage Fact Sheet number 83 has a table where you can compare the TDN percentage that you might have received in your forage test and the ADF percentage, and how they may indicate a different TDN result based on your ADF. A quick analysis tip is also to always compare dry matter values. This allows you to compare something like silage with hay, because now you're comparing apples to apples when the water is removed and there's no dilution of the nutrients. As you remember, Barry listed a number of macro and micro minerals that are really important in cattle nutrition for various reasons, and there's different values that are required. There's a deficiency potential and there's a toxicity potential. Forage Fact Sheet number 83 has a detailed table that shows you for calcium, phosphorus, magnesium, potassium, sulfur, and selenium, the deficiency symptoms and the toxicity symptoms. So please go have a look at the fact sheet, because I really don't think you would remember all these numbers if I list off a long list of percentages and what the symptoms might be. One thing to note, though, is with selenium, because in the Peace region, soils are often deficient in selenium, so it is needed to be supplemented to livestock. If there's a deficiency with selenium, you will observe white muscle disease, which will present with calves that are weak, stiff, and seem double-jointed, and you may have cows with retained placentas. Minerals by themselves are really important, but so are mineral ratios. Minerals have many interactions with each other, and some in particular are very important. Calcium and phosphorus is kind of the classic and should be monitored and maintained at a ratio of 2:1 to 7:1 of calcium to phosphorus. Maintaining this ratio is important because calcium and phosphorus play an important role in bone formulation, bone turnover, and nerve functions. Potassium, magnesium, and calcium interact to make the tetany ratio, which is potassium as a ratio to magnesium and calcium together. This is how grass tetany can be prevented. The maximum this ratio can be is 2:2:1, so 2:2 of potassium to one element of magnesium and calcium together. If potassium is too high, say over 1.75%, and one of the other two are low, calcium or magnesium, then this ratio will be out of whack and livestock performance will be affected. Also important are vitamins. Again, Forage Fact Sheet number 83 has a list of the vitamins that are fat-soluble, which are A, D, E, K, and the water-soluble minerals of vitamin B and C. Again, it will show you what they're important for and what sort of deficiency symptoms you might be observing. As we touched on in Barry's interview, salt is the one nutrient that animals can regulate for. But how much salt should be in a ration? On a feed analysis, you will see sodium, or Na, reported. A rule of thumb for salt is that Na, or sodium, times 2.5 equals sodium chloride, which is salt. If the sodium content of a feed is 0.1% or more, then the salt, the sodium chloride, would be 0.25% or more, which would be all the salt the animal requires. If you are supplementing salt, cattle will consume about 75% of their salt intake at night, so be sure to place the salt close to where the animals usually sleep. As we mentioned, salt is one of the few feedstuffs that livestock will seek out and consume willingly, so if you're mixing in minerals, because they're sometimes bitter or less desired, mix in the loose salt and minerals to increase mineral consumption. In summary, a feed analysis is only as good as the feed sample that is taken. Again, follow the procedures outlined in Forage Fact Sheet number 18 and the step-by-step guide that Barry gave in episode 3 of this podcast. The first two most important nutrients to analyze are protein and energy. Determine which group of cattle your feed is most suited for. Is it good for mature cows or better for growing heifers, and assess if you're going to have to supplement maybe energy and or protein in your feeding ration. Once energy and protein are balanced, then you can take a look at your minerals and vitamins. Follow the rules of thumbs provided in fact sheet number 83 and what Barry talked about in his interview. Remember that you can access Cow Bites, which is one of the rationing programs, or Sheep Bites. You can also reach out to cattle nutritionists to get some help with your feed analysis and how to put together the best nutrition for your cattle. That brings us to the end of this episode. As always, please stop by at peaceforage.bc.ca to check out all the forage fact sheets that we mentioned and for more goodies that are in there. Also reach out to let us know what you would like to hear on this podcast. Email us at coordinator@peaceforage.bc.ca. We always welcome your feedback. And hey, if you like this podcast, give it a like and share it with friends. So long. May the forage be with you.